Okay, folks, we're going to go ahead and start the meeting. It's a few minutes after 10. My name is Janice Bellucci, and this is the monthly Zoom meeting for the Alliance for Constitutional Sex Offense Laws. It is indeed Saturday, June 20th, and let's go ahead and get started. I want to welcome everybody who's here today. It's wonderful to see you and your faces. I know some people are in California, and I know other people are outside the state of California. Everybody is indeed welcome. Today, when we talk about these topics, what I'm going to attempt to do is talk about the topics that are of national importance and interest first, and then second, I will talk about California news and litigation, etc. So at any time during the meeting, please understand that you are welcome to ask a question or you're welcome to make a comment. I ask that you put your hand up. If you can do it here electronically, that would be great. Using the button on the bottom there, raise hand. Otherwise, if you literally raise your hand, I can also call on you that way. So, but I don't see all the photos at the same time. So that can be a problem, just to let you know. All right. So before I move on, I want to share with you that we do in fact have four board members with us here this morning. Roger Honeycutt is a board member. He's also a co-host of the meeting, so he can help admit people and also remove people if in fact they need to be removed. We also have Rick Chu. Rick is a board member. Roger and Rick and Joe, by the way, are all members of the Foundation Board of Directors. Welcome, Joe. And then Sherry has just joined, and Sherry is with me, a member of the ACSOL, Alliance for Constitutional Sex Offense Laws. So we've got all kinds of people here who care a lot about this topic. That's why they're board members, folks. And just to let you know, on the AXL board alone, we have five lawyers. I'm just one of the five, and we're here to support you. So we're here to give you hope. We're here to give you support, and we're here to accept you. We are judgment-free zone. So when you contact us, please understand we will not judge you. We want to help you. We know that it's almost like a minefield out there, trying to navigate and basically to do it safely and not end up back in jail or prison. So, having said that, I do want to ask, I do want to make a few announcements. One, our annual conference is coming up in October, so please write this down and join us if you can, October 2nd and October 3rd. It will be in Los Angeles near the LAX airport. So, the LAX airport, we're telling you that so that you can make your flight plans. We're not going to tell you yet where the hotel is because we had a sister organization that basically was prevented from having a conference at a hotel because some people who, let's say, are unfriendly to our cause called the hotel, made a lot of noise, and to the point where the hotel in that case canceled the contract. So we're not going to risk that. We're not. Okay. I also want to warn people one more time about scam calls. When we had the meeting in Pasadena a week ago, some people told me that the scammers have been active in Los Angeles County recently. And so, please, folks, if somebody calls you up and tells you that your DNA has been damaged or any other excuse that they give you, then, and it sounds, many times, by the way, it sounds like people are calling from a real police station with the noise in the background and everything. They are really good at what they do, and they basically hook people emotionally. And one of the things they'll tell you is stay on the phone. Don't hang up. We're going to come and get you if you don't do what we tell you to do. And the other thing is indeed they will be asking you for money. And I know one person in LA County who gave them $10,000. By the way, if you give them any money whatsoever, you'll never see it again. They have you pay like a cryptocurrency or gift cards or something like that, which cannot be tracked. So with the scammer, it's really easy answer. If a scammer calls you, the easiest thing to do is just hang up. Even though they tell you not to hang up, please hang up because that's all they want is your attention. And if you don't give them your attention, they'll go away and go call somebody else. So please watch out for scammers. All righty. Again, I want to repeat, we're going to be talking about some national issues first, then we're going to be talking about California state issues. But before we talk about either of those issues, I would like Marty to talk about some other services that we provide, other types of support that we provide in addition to these monthly meetings.
My
Marty?
pleasure, Janice. And you'll see I just posted something in the chat window. So, how well we know the traumas inflicted by the registry, pardon me, whoa, on ourselves and our loved ones. Bullying, isolation, loneliness, loss of family and friends, struggling to secure work and housing. Life can be difficult for every person affected. That's why Axol runs emotional support group meetings every week. Our next meetings will be on Thursday and 1 week from today. And these groups are not just for registrants. Our loved ones and supporters are welcome to attend too. Every Thursday evening, Axol board member Sherry Moreno runs the group beginning at 6:30 Pacific, 9:30 Eastern. The second and fourth Saturday of each month, licensed therapist Alex Gittinger leads the Saturday afternoon meeting. The time, 3 o'clock Pacific, 6 o'clock Eastern. At every meeting, we have a supportive community here for each other. There's no cost, and we vet every participant, so don't look for trolls, bullies, law enforcement, or haters, because you won't find them in our meetings. How can you participate in these wonderful groups? Well, take a look at the information that I just posted in the chat. If you don't have access to the chat, you're on the phone. You can click the emotional support group link on the Axol Emotional on the Axol homepage and follow the direction. And I promise, after participating in the Axol Emotional Support Groups, you will feel a lot better about yourself. One final anecdote, and I am going to start changing these anecdotes moving forward. And by the way, these are my personal thoughts, opinions, and do not represent those of any organization or any person. Thought I would throw that in there for you, Janice.
Thank you.
The people who throw hateful taunts at you and me post pictures of wood chippers, I'd say 99% of those people would never consider helping a crime victim or even reaching out to ask a victim how they're feeling. So the next time those teasers ask you, and remember, this is my opinion, ask them, why are you wasting all your time and energy hating me when you could be helping crime victims recover? What's wrong with you? Back to you, Janice.
Thank you, Marty.
My pleasure.
Yeah, so I hope you all, well, I want to thank Marty too for putting information in the chat part of this Zoom meeting. There's all kinds of things you can click on there. It talks about the days and times of the emotional support group meetings. By the way, in fact, Sherry, who's on the call today, she's also leads one of those meetings. Sherry, do you want to say anything about that, your meetings?
Yeah, it's just a lot of the people who come to these groups, they said it feels more like a family. Sometimes we talk about things that are registry related. Other times we're just talking about life in itself because granted, life still gets thrown our way. We're still dealing with everyday life stuff as well. So if you're interested, like was said, please click on the links and reach out to myself or to Alex Gittinger, and we connect with you and get you connected to one or both of our groups.
Very good. Thank you, Sherry. Thank you very much. Okay, so folks, we are very fortunate today to have a guest speaker join us. Her name is Michelle Friedman, and I am so impressed by Michelle and the work that she's doing that I wanted to share it with you. Michelle has been invited to speak at the conference in October, so she's got about 15 minutes today, and she's going to have a lot longer to share information with you in October. So this is a bit of a teaser, Michelle.
Sounds good.
She is, in fact, the mother of a young man who is currently in custody because he was convicted of a sex offense. And she was so dismayed that the information she needed was not available to her. She started her own website and she's done a heck of a lot of research. I'm so impressed by your website, Michelle. So if you don't mind, Michelle, go ahead and take it away.
All right. Well, hopefully I will keep you all engaged and hopefully not take up the entire 15 minutes. Our family's entrance into the tsunami of the sex offender laws and registry happened on August 16th of 2022, roughly a week after the Mar-a-Lago raid. I found my own home being raided. When I was presented with a warrant, I asked, "What are we, Trump? Why are you here?" They were here to talk to our, at the time, 22-year-old son, Nick Met Quartz. My husband and I both come from a legal background, but outside, it's from the civil side. So my husband was a banking and financial institutions lawyer. I was an executive in law firm three management for 20 years. So fortunately, we had enough wherewithal to know not to allow our son to speak the dozens of police officers and SWAT members that were around our house. Nevertheless, that in August of 2022, and we then became engaged in a year-long negotiation plea with the prosecutors here in Arkansas, an exceptionally conservative county. Allegedly, when our son was 21 years old, a college student at a Catholic university, he belonged to a private anonymous Snapchat create image of underage minors to include revenge porn, ex-boyfriend post this, X, Y, and Z. We weren't really sure what the evidence was. They hired forensic investigator to go through everything, and I got exceedingly happy because I realized that there was these images had not, quote, been saved. They had cached. And in doing research, I realized, oh, wow, when you go on a website, images are cached. That's not something you necessarily do, something apps and websites do, so that the next time you go to them, the images will load more quickly. So I thought, wow, here, this could be our defense. If they can't prove that our son's alleged images, they were cached, we've got a ground to say there's no one here. Unfortunately, in the state of Wisconsin, one of the appellate court, the chief of the court, who also happens to be a family friend of ours, previously ruled that no, cached images do in fact prove intent. So we had really no way to argue our way out of what charges were. They initially charged him with 5 counts of possession of pornography for messages that were sent in July 2021 when he was 21 years old. Jaded back and forth, we asked if the prosecutor would consider pleading down to a lesser felony to allow for the time and allow the judge more discretion in sentencing. We were told that nope, our county is conservative and our constituents for it this way. So your son is either going to plead guilty once or we're going to throw more counts at him. So he pled guilty to one count.
Could I interrupt for just a second? Your signal seems to be a little spotty. Can you turn off your video so we can hear you clearly?
Yes.
Because it is choppy. Thank you.
All right. See, is that better? Okay. He pled guilty to one count. He was sentenced to mandatory minimum of 3 years in prison. We were lucky he got 2 years on paper as opposed to 3 and 15 years on the sex offender registry. Effectively, he will be 45 years old before this process is over for him. But as a parent, I was astounded at the things that I learned in relation to sex offender laws, to mandatory minimums, to the lack of cohesiveness in sentencing. There seemed to be no rhyme or reason. So for example, our son received 3 years, 2 years, and 15 years for allegedly having an inappropriate photograph. An adult male in the same county who was 38 years old, who had the same judge, same prosecutor, and was arrested for child enticement as a teacher for hands-on offenses, was in fact allowed to plead to a lesser offense that we were asking our son to. So there really is my husband says, and I think this is a good saying, comparison is the death when it comes to these circumstances. No one crime is, you know, worse or better. You have to deal with you have. So during our time navigating this storm, I became deeply depressed. I felt the stigma. I felt ashamed. My son is the only son. I worried immensely about his future and about what will happen to him in the future. And in so doing, I realized that sitting around worrying is not going to help the outcome. And if I'm a parent that is searching for all this information, finding it, I need to create it. And so I started building a website, which is called csamsupport.org, and I call it Support Beyond Stigma. And on that website, I try to address a number of different areas that were areas that came to my mind. For example, what are the U.S. laws, the differing laws throughout the U.S.? What emotional and psychological topics are people really wanting answers to? What are the legal and technology topics that we are wondering about? For example, me going down the rabbit hole of cached images versus saved images. What happens in prison? What happens when they reenter? What about the registry? So these are all topics that I've had so many questions about. And no matter how much research I did, I would find wonderful advocacy groups such as this one and Families Against Mandatory Minimum moms and others, but I didn't find a REIT specifically targeted to the loved ones of those who have been accused of possession of child pornography. I often feel, not just in this particular charge, but the loved ones of those who have been accused or convicted are secondary, and we suffer in a silent shame. And I think there needed to be a resource out there for us. And despite the stigma associated with it, I spent a year building it, and I continue to update it with news and case law and ideas and how to write character letters, because eventually I want it to be the resource for loved ones that they can turn to when they feel like they're alone. They're not alone. I felt like I was alone for 2 years. We were fortunate in that we had a lot of support from our loved ones, from my son's employer, from his friends. We were a fortunate family, but not every family is that fortunate. A lot of people really are left on the lurch, and it's not fair that they don't have access to information to comfort them when they're facing this storm. And so for that reason, I created Support Beyond Stigma, CSAM support. Now, the early numbers indicate that the website has only been up for 3 weeks. It has not been indexed by Google, meaning index websites for authority. Once your pages get indexed, you start showing up in search results more quickly. We're still in what's called the sandbox stage. Google's letting us play in the sandbox, but we're not fully indexed. Despite that, sites that launched can, on average, anticipate receiving between 50 and 100 visitors per month. Since this website was launched on May 27th, we have received over 870 unique visitors from across the United States and 8 different countries, and over 1,100 page views. For people that aren't familiar with website analytics, that blows the averages completely out of the waters, which says there certainly is a demographic out there that this resource will help. And so I believe that's why Janice asked me to speak today on some of the background, why this website was built. I am also on the side advocating other things for particular legislation within my state, writing to the Secretary of our Department of Corrections and other things. But my first goal was to build a resource for loved ones, because I know exactly what it likes to cry alone at night and not sleep and not eat. And so this was a way that I'm trying to get to our community, because this is something our family never entered.
Well, thank you, Michelle, for that wonderful presentation. I have gone on Michelle's website, and I'm so impressed by it. One of the things that impressed me, maybe because I'm a lawyer, is that, in fact, it's listed for every single state. So all 50 states, state by state, in alphabetical order. It does, in fact, maybe it's not a link, Michelle, I apologize. But I remember you have the information state by state about what's considered CSAM in that state. It is different from state to state.
It is very different from state to state. You know, in some states, had my son been accused in Iowa, this would have been a misdemeanor. Been accused in Florida, my God, he'd be in prison probably for life. But so there are various nuances. I also came across a resource that is really incredible. The probation, it's called PIN, and it's a network of probation professionals, their association, and they keep their website up to date as it relates to things you can and cannot do while on probation state by state. So I found that to be an incredible resource. Some people have been reaching out to that as well. One of the things is that there are a lot of people out there that have been impacted by family members being registered as sex offenders. They start a website with really, really good intentions, and then it just dies on the vine. It's still out there, but it's not really active. So I created a resource area after researching, and obviously this organization, I believe, is the first listed resources for families of active groups that are still active and participating in advocating or supporting in one way or another, whether it's legislation, whether it's second chance employment. And I plan on keeping that information up to date so that people affected can find all of that information in one place.
Yeah, it's quite a service to the community. So folks, if somebody has a question or a comment for Michelle, this is the time to share it. And please put your hand up one way or the other. Okay. And so, Michelle, I'm really looking forward to you speaking at the conference. I know you have a lot more to share with folks, and it'll be great to have you there. I'm going to just check little thumb, you know, small photos and stuff to see, in fact, if anybody has their hand up. I don't see it. But Michelle, you're certainly welcome to join us for the entire meeting, but it's not required. Okay, here comes somebody who's raised their hand. Pastor Ron.
Yeah, I put a comment in the chat there. I really need to share my own experience with Michelle, because I
had I did get your email.
Yeah, I had the same thing happen to me. It was one of those points. I was at a very, very low point in my life. I had a pornography addiction, and this was like 15 years ago. But boy, they never forget, do they? You do one thing wrong, and they never forget. You do 50 things right, and they never remember. But it's one of those situations where, you know, I had 14 images of they were, I guess, girls between like 15 and 17, they were almost old enough, you know what I mean? And, but that's what they charged me with. And, they actually sentenced me to 3 to 6 years in prison for that, which was actually an illegal sentence. I found out about it afterwards. 1.5 to 3 was the statutory sentence, and they enhanced it. When I went back through the transcript of the trial, the judge, for some strange reason, thought I was a repeat offender, and he applied an enhanced sentence. And I thought, no, wait a minute, my lawyer was absolutely worthless. But anyway, I have no recourse now, I don't think, after all this time. But, I didn't know about it till after the fact. But come on. And, I met guys in there who had actual sexual contact with minors, 12, 13, 14-year-old girls, who had less time than I did. What is wrong with this system that people are being allowed to do this? These legislators are out of their minds.
I'm going to ask you to stop there.
Okay.
I agree with your message completely. I do. And I don't understand. Well, the system's broken. I mean, the system's broken in the state of California, is broken federally. Michelle, I'm forgetting your son was convicted in state court. Is that right?
Yeah, he was. Thank God, not federal. So, but still here in Wisconsin, we have mandatory minimums. And I will tell you that the judge did say the judge wasn't allowed to consider any mitigating factors. Claim for the off, so I'm not breaking up. But the judge did say that, but for the fact his hands were tied by mandatory minimums, the outcome would be much different, meaning our son would not be in jail. He would likely be on probation or parole.
I understand.
Or deferred prosecution. But yeah.
One of the conversations Michelle and I go ahead, Michelle.
I was going to find the link to, somebody asked the PIN question, so I'm going to add that link into the chat.
Okay, thank you. One of the conversations that Michelle and I have had, and I've had it with a few others over the years, is I really believe that a diversionary court needs to be established for people who in fact have viewed child pornography. There's diversionary court, at least in California, for alcohol and drugs. And I believe that this is an addiction as well. And so come on, folks, let's go ahead and create a diversionary court. It seems like a huge mountain, huge mountain to climb. I don't know if I'll ever get to the top of it, but that's one of my long-term projects that I have. Kathleen, you have your hand up. And by the way, Kathleen is also a board member. I didn't see you earlier when I was identifying board members. She's a member of the foundation board.
I know who I am. Yes. Thank you, Janice. Michelle, I would like to say, you mentioned that the rules and the laws and the way they handle this is different state to state. It can be different even county to county. I live in San Diego, California County, and I happened to see, after my husband was convicted of CP, that she stated publicly that any man convicted of that, or any person convicted of that, would, in her area, would be tried federally. And there is no misdemeanor in federal court. It's all a felony.
Thank you,
he's gone. Thank goodness. Pardon?
Oh, did she leave? No, Michelle's here. The district attorney's gone. Yes.
Yeah, she's gone.
Yeah, no, I'm not gone. I'm sorry.
I can see her clearly. Thank you, Michelle, and for all you do.
No problem. And I did add, for the person that asked for the PIN info, I put that link in just now. I think that would be honestly the most up-to-date resource because it's an association of probation officers. So that's going to be probably more than any individual independent resource and information.
Great. Wonderful. Thank you for sharing information about your website as well as this other web. So folks, I am going to ask you, if you're not speaking to the group, would you please mute yourself because we are hearing some background noise. Cristobal, please go ahead.
Cristobal, yes. When our son was accused of a sex offense in Portland, Oregon, that's where he was living, we, through a friend of his, we reached out to the former DA that had been in Portland, Oregon for 31 years. And yes. He said to me, look, what they have done with any sex offense, they have politicized this. It has become a political issue. It becomes a witch hunt. He said, because many years before, this happened like 9 years ago. He said, they used to send them to probation. They used to send them to therapy, but nowadays they send them to these long sentences. He said, many years in jail, no treatment. So what's the point? And then he referred us to a good lawyer that took on his case. And when he was sentenced, the judge and the defense lawyer, they were quite upset because they said, look, justice has not been served because, he said, the man that the judge was almost 94 years old at that time. And he said, look, I am unhappy because the federal government gives us this mandatory minimum sentencing guidelines, and they don't give us the flexibility to taking into account the previous personal history of the person being judged. So the judge and the lawyer were extremely unhappy. This is all I want to add to Michelle's comments. Thank you.
And thank you, Cristobal, for that information. Thank you. Okay. Folks, if you don't mind, I'm going to go ahead. We've got another hand up. Sorry. Kelly, go ahead. You have a question or a comment?
Yes. Can I ask an SB 384 question?
Yes.
Okay. First of all, first time attending this group, I'm glad I found you guys. So I want to know how the court will view my time registered in Texas. My case was in 2005, California, moved to Texas in 2013. I've been continually registered. I'm moving back permanently to California this July.
All the time you registered in Texas will count.
Can I follow up question?
Okay, but we're really not talking about this yet. So can you hold your question, Kelly?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Later in the meeting? Okay, I appreciate it. Yes, as I said earlier, we're going to talk about national issues first, and then we're going to move on to California issues. So hang in there. I promise we'll get to it. All right. Thank you. Okay. So thank you again, Michelle, for sharing with us about your experience and your website. Also, the information here about the other organization and the other website. Folks, this is what it's all about. We need to share information with each other because otherwise people have the experience like Michelle had in, you know, entering some dark tunnel and not knowing, quite frankly, what's going on. I've unfortunately heard Michelle's story many times. What's different about Michelle, though, is she's done something about it. So something very credible and reaching out to help other families, too. So again, thank you, Michelle, for doing it. Okay, folks, so I am going to move on now to talk about one quick state issue, and you'll know why in a minute, because I want everybody to know we have very good news to share. And so Assembly Bill 1568, which was pending here in California, has been stopped, okay? So registrants, again, the registrant community, we made phone calls, we sent emails, we sent letters. I can't tell you exactly what stopped it, but it stopped. And this was, I would say, a miracle, because this bill was an Assembly Bill. It passed two committees. Thank you, John, for the thumbs up. It passed two committees in the assembly side. It was passed on the assembly floor as well, unanimously in every situation. Not by a majority, but unanimously approved by everybody in the assembly. And then, lo and behold, it went over to the Senate, and it sure looked like a freight train coming in our direction. You know, the light was coming in our direction. No, it's not good. And so we were waiting we had to wait for a Senate committee hearing. It was supposed to have taken place Tuesday of this past week on June 16th. And I was going to testify at that hearing. And I have to tell you, I was not looking forward to testifying because I thought I testified on the assembly side. And when I did, they ignored it. And I was like, well, I'm going to say what I need to say. And they'll probably ignore it as well. But to everybody's surprise, if not shock, in fact, the author of the bill, the day before it was to be heard in that Senate committee, withdrew the bill. So I hope that you all pat yourself on the back, that in fact you were part of this great victory. It also proves that we can in fact do what needs to be done in the legislature. And so one of the things that we are working on at Axol right now, we're planning ahead for next year, because basically this year is, there's nothing we can do this year to improve the tiered registry law, but we think we can improve it next year through legislation. And so I want you to know that we're actively working on it. Because we're actively working on it, we have started a matching grant program. And so if in fact you can support the organization in any way, please do so. Rick, I don't usually give this commercial. You want to give the rest of it? How can people donate to Axol?
I'm sorry. Are you asking me, Janice?
Yes. Or maybe I should ask Roger. Roger?
I think Roger might be more appropriate.
All right. Roger, if somebody wants to make a donation to Axol, what's the easiest way to do it?
All you got to do is go to our website. And on the right-hand side of every single page, we have a donate button. And there's also alternative ways that you can donate. If you want to send a check, the instructions are there too. You'll see a link. But we cherish every dollar that you send. You don't have to give $1 million. Smaller donations do add up to change, and we use that very efficiently. You know, we don't have a giant building, we don't have massive staff of people. We're a pretty lean and mean organization. And I mean, look at what we just did with this bill. So please consider, you know, giving us money. The more that we have, the more we can do. That's the bottom line. You know, there's a long list of things we'd love to do, and we need the resources to do it, but you can help make that change.
Hey, thank you, Roger. Folks, let's talk about some pending federal legislation as well. There are four bills that we've been following. One of them has to do with Medicaid benefits. A Republican from Florida, his last name is Staub, S-T-A-U-B-E, he introduced a bill. It's H.R. 7453, and that would, in fact, end Medicaid benefits for people just because they're on the registry. H.R. 7624 would actually prohibit people on the registry from entering into a federal shelter. H.R. 7702 would, in fact, introduce a death penalty as a possibility, not mandatory, but discretionary for a judge to apply for people who are convicted of an offense involving a minor. And the last one has to do with federal pensions. It's a Senate bill. The number I don't have with me right now, but was introduced by Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. I think is how she pronounces her name. So I'm happy to report that these bills so far are going absolutely nowhere. They're supposed to go in front of committees for consideration and stuff before they would go to the floor of the House or the Assembly. I'm sorry, the House or the Senate. So far, they're not going those places. So just like our state legislature, every 2 years, if in fact these bills are not approved in 2026, they will in fact be erased, and the process could be started again next year, but there's no guarantee that it will. And we can hope that they don't. So again, those four federal bills are not moving forward, but we're watching them because in fact, if they should move forward, then we will ask you all to make phone calls and to send letters to the legislatures, either the House of Representatives or the U.S. Senate. So
I wrote a letter to ours when regarding the medic, and I'd be happy to share that with people. I sent it to, you know, to our federal.
Thank you.
Act, and I received a positive response. So I'll send that to you, and you can distribute as you feel appropriate.
Fabulous. So, Michelle, did you just say you got a response to your letter?
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Was it like a form letter, or was it something different?
No, it was from Brothman, who's our senator, federal. He had his assistant respond back thanking me for the counter arguments I provided and said, if you would like to speak with him personally, let me know. So, yeah.
Great.
I just really outlined how it was nonsensical. How are you going to get across all of these? You're taxing them, and then you're going to say that they're not eligible for things that the government taxed for, and this is just going to be a big quagmire, and it doesn't make any sense. So I'll send that.
Okay, fabulous. Thank you, Michelle. Okay, so let's talk about SORNA litigation. When it comes to SORNA litigation, this is a lawsuit that was started a couple of years ago. Axel is a plaintiff in the case. We are not indeed the litigators, which is actually is a good thing because PLF has a much larger organization with a lot more resources than we have. So they the decision came out in the case in April, and the latest thing that's happened in that is in fact that the federal government has filed a notice of appeal in the case. So what are they appealing? What they're appealing is that the federal district court judge in this case issued a decision that said yes, indeed, that that part of the lawsuit having to do with due process, that in fact due process had been violated with the issuance of these regulations, and also issued a statewide permanent injunction. So it's only unfortunately applies to the state of California, but basically in California, if you are a registrant that lives here in California, the SORNA regulations do not apply to you. Unfortunately, they apply in the other 49 states, according to the federal government. So a notice of appeal is just that. It's a notice. It's not the actual appellate brief, but the fact is this case continues to go on. It's not a surprise, folks, because and from the very beginning, the Pacific Legal Foundation said they thought that indeed this case would be appealed. And so it's now just finished at the district court level. It's been the notice of appeal was filed with the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal. Okay. And so that's who's going to hear it next. This is something too. There's at least a possibility that this case could end up before the U.S. Supreme Court. So stay tuned about SORNA. Let's talk about Halloween signs. There's pending litigation in Missouri. It's barely pending. And what I mean by that is we got very favorable decisions from both the district court judge and also from the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. They basically declared that that a state law that required registrants to post a sign on their home on Halloween was unconstitutional because it was indeed compelled speech. So that was wonderful. And the federal district court originally issued a permanent statewide injunction, and that was fabulous. But the fact is, there's a U.S. Supreme Court case now. It's called Trump versus CASA. And that case talks about universal injunctions and then said universal injunctions are bad. So what's happened is with the trial court, they changed the remedy in that case. Instead of there being a permanent statewide injunction in Missouri, now it only applies to one person, and that's a plaintiff in the case. So Axel's talking to an organization in Missouri about what to do next. Stay tuned for that. But the fact is that, again, both in addition to which, the Attorney General of Missouri has stated that they are going to file a petition with the U.S. Supreme Court asking that court to grant review of the decision, the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals decision. I really think that's unlikely to happen, but I guess they feel compelled to go through that process. And so their deadline for requesting review of the U.S. Supreme Court is next month in July. So stay tuned for that. Again, it's disappointing that the district court judge changed the remedy. It's disappointing and understandable both that the U.S. Supreme Court, I'm sorry, that the district court judge changed the remedy in the case and now is only applicable to one person, directly applicable. But we're hoping that enough of the law enforcement officials throughout the state of Missouri see that, you know, the handwriting's on the wall. This district court and the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals both agree that those signs are unconstitutional and they won't enforce the law. But we don't know for sure that's what's going to happen. So we are, again, talking to other people, another organization in Missouri. And in fact, I'm going to appear in a Zoom meeting with them in the next 10 days or so and talk about the case and seeing if anybody wants to serve as a plaintiff and future litigation. So that's the SORNA litigation, that's the Halloween sign case in Missouri. Moving on to Section 8 housing. Folks, there's a federal regulation that says that if in fact if you're required to register for life, you cannot get Section 8 housing. You can't get it on your own and you can't live with anybody in anybody else's Section 8 housing either. Well, after California became a tiered registry state, now people who are in tier one and tier two in California now can qualify for Section 8 housing. And so in any other state as well. So folks, if you need some help with that, let me know. I've written many letters to folks that have the Section 8 housing that provide it, and told them that, in fact, if somebody's, I'm very specific too, if in fact somebody would not or would qualify for Section 8 housing, to let them know. Because they're federal officials. They don't pay attention necessarily to what's going on in states. So to clarify for them, to educate them that, in fact, a person is eligible for Section 8 housing, it's really helped a lot of people. And Pastor Ron, I see your hand up, sir. Why don't you go ahead and unmute yourself?
Okay.
We can hear you now.
Oh, okay. Georgia's scheme says that people who are registered citizens can't live in an apartment complex, Section 8 or otherwise. You have to live in a standalone building somewhere out away from other people because they believe that there might be children living in that apartment complex. No registered citizen can live in an apartment complex.
What state is that? Georgia?
Georgia.
Wow. Okay. Yeah.
I don't see how they get away with that, but it creates a real problem because, you know, we've talked about this here in our Restore Georgia meetings that, you know, like here in the town that's next door to where I live here, there's a lot of apartment complexes, but there are no registered citizens living in any of them. They cannot live in them. And then we have this crazy thing that says you can't live within 1,000 feet of a school or a church. They used to say you can't live within 1,000 feet of a bus stop. But they finally stopped enforcing that because bus stops change every year. One of the things that we did successfully change is the grandfather rule that let's say the church buys the property across the street from me. They can't force me to move because I was here first.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, that we did get that changed. But, you know, how does that sound to you? I mean, to me, it doesn't sound right. Say, well, you can't live in an apartment complex because there might be a kid living there.
Well, I'll say it doesn't sound right, but I don't know what the law specifically says. So Ron, again, I would be willing to talk to you outside this meeting. Okay. We can talk about the specifics. I need to actually read the law before I can be more specific. Yeah. I know in many states there are residency restrictions. We used to have them in California until we filed about 50, 60 lawsuits and we got rid of them in California. But but it was a hard battle. And by the way, we had a state Supreme Court decision in our favor, and it was still difficult. So thank you. Okay, so moving on, let's talk about travel. Every month we talk about domestic and international travel, and we do that because it's really an important issue. So for people who are on the registry, you have limitations of where you can travel, whether it's domestically or overseas. In some respects, I think that traveling domestically is more difficult than overseas, though there are more places you can go domestically than overseas. But this is the reason why. So I say this, every single state in the nation has their own laws about who can visit their state, who is required to register in another state, or in some cases, even who in fact has been convicted of a sex offense, even if you're not currently required to register. So let me give you some examples. If you go to Nevada, it's 48 hours. So you have up to 48 hours to visit without registering, but on that 49th hour, it triggers the requirement to register in Nevada. Then you go to Hawaii. It's kind of on the other end of the spectrum, and that is you can go to Hawaii for up to 10 days without registering. Okay, and there's a lack of clarity here as to who triggers these requirements. Is it somebody who's currently required to register where they were convicted, or is it somebody who has ever been convicted of a sex offense? And the answer is not clear because it's state by state, and many times, you know, whatever the law says, let's say in California, as far as a specific sex offense, that may or may not be a registrable offense in another state. So there's one other place. If you want to visit the District of Columbia as a visitor, not move there, but if you want to go visit the District of Columbia, they do not require you to register at all. You can go and stay as long as you want. David, I see your hand up. By the way, David is also a board member. He is on the AXL Board of Directors. Welcome, David.
Hello, Janice. How are you doing today?
Doing great, thanks. And you?
Good, good. Great meeting so far. Hey, one thing that you just mentioned really rings a bell with me. For those of us who are fortunate, in my case, thanks to Janice, to be removed from the registry. That really rings true about what the exact law says when I'm visiting other states. I guess the best thing for me to do is do that research and find out what the state says.
Oh, sorry. Absolutely, it's necessary to do the research. Please, please, before you go visit another state, research it. We have information available on our website. Roger added it there. They're about domestic travel. And, you know, it's absolutely important for you to do that. One of the things we're trying to do, we're recommending that you not register in another state. And the reason we're making that recommendation, quite frankly, has to do more with international travel, believe it or not. So I just want you, so we'll talk about that in that context in a little bit. But if you are required to register in a state and you don't register in that state, that is, in fact, a failure to register. And you could end up in state prison or even possibly federal prison because you don't register. And that whole saying that you've heard since grade school, I would imagine, about ignorance of the law is no excuse, is true. So just because, even though you don't know you're breaking the law when you're visiting, the fact is you, in fact, could break the law unintentionally. So, what David was just saying, I think, is true, to do the research ahead of time. And by the way, if you're going to go visit a particular state like every year on a regular basis, it may be in your best interest to hire an attorney in that state to help explain the laws to you. And I know there could be some trouble and some expense to do that. But again, it might be well worth it for you to do exactly that. And I have referrals, not in every state, but in many states, I can refer you to an attorney in another state if, in fact, you are going to visit that state on a regular basis. This can apply whether it's personal, like you want to go to Aunt Sally's house for Thanksgiving every year, or it could be business too, because your corporate headquarters are in another state. It really makes a lot of sense for you to research this before you go. So are there any specific questions about domestic travel before I move on? Michelle, go ahead. Michelle, can you unmute yourself?
Yeah.
There you go. Okay.
So we've had a lot of discussions at a group here that I belong to, in that a lot of the restrictions, such as how many feet you can be away from a pool or a park, those restrictions allegedly in Wisconsin only apply when you're on paper. Mm-hmm. Once you're off paper, the restrictions are different, even if you have a monitor. So I'm still trying to navigate understanding that, the difference between on paper restrictions and off paper restrictions, because I think a lot of people like myself assume that when these restrictions are in place, it's a forever. And I'm not sure that's true.
I have to admit, I was partially distracted reading something in the chat room, but I think you were asking, well, if you don't mind, would you repeat your question?
Well, the question is the restrictions, especially in relation to be 1,000 feet from the pool, 250 from a kindergarten, those restrictions are obvious when they're on paper, you can violate them. But once you're off paper, off extended supervision, do those restrictions still apply? I've been told here in Wisconsin by registered sex offenders that they do not, that in fact, yes, you can go to a beach, yes, you can swim in a pool, etc.
And Michelle, I agree with that person, whoever told you that. It's the same in California. So in California, we don't have residency restrictions and we don't have what's called presence restrictions when you're not on paper, when you get off of paper. So for those who are listening, please understand on paper means on parole or probation. So in California, probation is not as strict as parole. There are fewer conditions on probation as compared to parole, but there's still conditions. And so, yes, when you're on parole or probation, you in fact have to be cognizant of those restrictions. But once you're no longer on parole or probation, then they no longer apply to you. Thank you for that. Bringing up that point. Okay, so let's talk about overseas travel. There's something called the International Megan's Law. International Megan's Law basically talks about people that convict. They use the term covered sex offender. So covered sex offender under International Megan's Law is somebody who's been convicted of a sex offense and involving a minor and is required to register. So think about convicted of a sex offense involving a minor plus required to register in any state. The reason that we're recommending that you register in as few states as possible is because of International Megan's Law. So for example, and David spoke earlier, I did indeed help him get off the registry here in California. Okay. And so that was great. And under, I'm qualifying my language and stumbling a little bit because David also was required to register in Florida at one point in time. Okay. Once he got off the Florida and the California registries, he was not on a registry anymore. And therefore the International Megan's Megan's Law did not apply to him. So, I mean, it's so sad. And this did happen to me recently with one of my clients. He did not remember that he had been, that he was still on the registry of another state. And so I wrote a letter or an email to the Department of Homeland Security asking them to take him off the list and such. And they said, oh, but he's still required to register in this other state, even though he's no longer required to register in California. So, okay. So if you're a covered sex offender, then what do you have to do? The requirements of International Megan's Law are two. One, you have to notify within 21 days or longer before you travel overseas. You have to notify the office where you register that you're going to travel overseas. And each office has different requirements, by the way. Some people let you do it on the phone, some by email, and some require you to come in person. But anyway, the 21-day notice. The other thing is, I think, worse. It's called a unique identifier. Okay. So unique identifier is something that our government is now adding to passports of people who are covered sex offenders. Now, I have a huge problem with that, right? To me, it's like a scarlet letter, literally, that they're going to put a notice on your passport that you were convicted of a sex offense involving a minor. The language to me is vague. It doesn't really say, well, how long ago were you convicted? How old was your victim? You know, et cetera. And so when somebody else reads that language, another country, they often interpret it, I would imagine they always interpret it using their own criteria. So if you have, you know, if you have a country where the age of consent is less than 18, that's what they think. Oh, you must have been involved with a 12-year-old, when in fact your victim was 16 or 17. So so I am very opposed to unique identifiers, but this is the problem. If in fact, I'm going to ask people to mute themselves again, please. I can hear somebody in the background. So if in fact you if in fact you have this unique identifier on your passport and this language that's vague, again, the state or the country where you're traveling to is going to interpret their way by their laws, which many times are not the same, of course, as our laws. So this is something you want to avoid if possible. I will tell you, Roger and Rick, would you please mute everybody except me? With that unique identifier on your passport, anybody can see it when you're traveling, because now they put it on page one of the passport. It used to be in the endorsement pages or in the back of the passport, but now indeed they're in the front of the passport on page one. So some people have been able to travel freely despite the unique identifier on the passport. And David, if you're still here, maybe you can add on to this. I know you had a unique identifier on your passport for a while and it didn't cause you a problem, but David kept going to the same country mostly. And it was, the country was France. And France is one of the 29 Schengen nations that allow people who are on the registry in California to travel there. So I speak very highly of the Schengen nations. The four large ones, by the way, are Italy, Spain, France, and Germany, that people with a unique identifier on their passport, they allow you to enter, and there's not a problem. But let me tell you what the downside of not having a unique identifier on your passport. If you're a covered sex offender and you don't have a unique identifier on your passport, the problem is that the State Department can, in fact, revoke your passport at any time. And it's caused some problems, really big problems. And I'll just share a quick story with you about one of my clients who, in fact, that he was no longer required to register here in California. I'm sorry, that's not true. He was a covered sex offender, and he and his wife were going to travel overseas. And in fact, they had checked their bags, they had boarded the plane, and somebody from Department of Homeland Security came on the plane and tapped him on the shoulder and basically told him he had to get off the plane because his passport had been revoked. Well, he pulls the passport out of his pocket, right? And he says, no, it isn't. Here's my passport. And then the person from Department of Homeland Security took it away from him right then and there, took his passport away. So they did not go to travel overseas. And by the way, it was the registrant and his wife, and they were going there to celebrate their 30th wedding anniversary. So they did not make it to Europe on that trip. David, I see you again. Do you want to add anything here about the experiences you had traveling with the passport?
Yes, thank you, Janice. I'd be happy to. Can you hear me okay?
Great, yes.
Fantastic. Sorry, everyone. I had a technical glitch. Battery died on me. Yes, I traveled quite a bit, first with a marked passport and now with an unmarked passport, always entering Paris, the Charles de Gaulle Airport. Really never had a problem with it. including with the marked passport. One occasion, the customs or border officer looked at the additional page and the notification and then just sort of looked quizzically at me, shrugged his shoulders and said, "Welcome to France." So honestly, EU, I've never had a problem anywhere in EU. I will note, however, that I stay at VRBOs. That's like Airbnbs. I do not stay at hotels. The one time that I did stay at a hotel, I was a little concerned because hotels will photocopy your passport and keep the information. And that made me rather uncomfortable. VRBOs and Airbnbs, to the best of my knowledge, do not do that. I've also not encountered any restrictions there. However, one individual did exclude me from renting their place. Never got any information as to why, but I suspect maybe she looked me up on the internet or something. I don't know. Anyway, that was just one out of hundreds that I've rented. So please, yeah, I recommend to everyone, please travel. Please travel. Enjoy yourselves.
All right. So you do have a question here about, did you move between countries with ease?
Honestly, I did not. I didn't go to any other countries. But one time I did fly into Sweden and then went to flew over to France from there. No problem whatsoever. I had no problem entering Sweden, not the slightest issue, and no problem entering France. So no issue whatsoever.
All right. Thank you for sharing that. We do have a comment here. Somebody said, I traveled to France numerous times and to other Schengen nations from France with no problems. And it says, we always stay in hotels, no issues. My Good. Travels from France to Portugal and Italy were no problem. And then somebody Excellent. Asked, does it matter if the offense involved a minor? I would say no. Because, in fact, you're not a covered sex offender unless your offense involved a minor. All right. Thank you, David.
If it matters, mine did involve a minor, and it was 30 years ago.
So. All right. Thank you.
Yeah. You. One item. You do not have to do the 21-day advanced travel notification unless it involves a minor, I believe. I think if you did CP or something, I don't know if you have to do 21-day or not. Maybe. Janice, you know.
Oh, that they believe that involves a minor, yes.
Okay.
Somebody else added, we did a European river cruise, flew into Munich, train to Vienna, river cruise to Amsterdam. I book Airbnb in my name, not my husband's name. So that's a tip from somebody here who's joining us today. Thank you for that. Okay. Pastor Ron has your hand up. Please go ahead.
Yeah, I just had a quick question. If it was found unconstitutional to put a scarlet letter on a driver's license, how can you put it on a passport?
That's a really technical explanation. I'm not sure I'm up to it right now, Ron, but this is weird. The federal government says that your passport is not your personal property. It's the federal government's property. That's the basic reason.
I thought that a driver's license was also a property of the state because they can take it from you upon, you know, commission of a serious traffic offense or something. It's not actually yours. They can revoke it and take it from you.
Well, I know in California, our driver's license is considered a privilege and not a right, but
yeah.
I don't know. Maybe I don't want to bring that up to any state. They might try to use the same argument, right? That your driver's license is not personal property. But and also, folks, believe it or not, I know we Americans love to travel, including traveling abroad, but according to all the case law out there, traveling overseas, you don't have a right to travel overseas, believe it or not. And that shocked me the first time I read it. And then I kept reading and researching, and I found out there was even a U.S. Supreme Court justice at one time. He happens to be one of my favorite, William O. Douglas, who was denied a passport. They wouldn't even give him a passport, even though he was a U.S. Supreme Court justice at the time, because he, in fact, had an affair with a married woman. I mean, what? So anyway, times change they do change, but the shocking thing is, again, we don't have the right to travel overseas. By the way, the country of Australia, it's my understanding, I don't know if it's current, but it used to be in Australia, if you're on the sex offender registry, they would not let you leave their country if you're on the registry. And I mean, I find that totally shocking. Australia is an island. I know it's a big island, but still it's an island. And they're telling you that you can't leave that island. Maybe a discussion for another day. Emmy, you've been very patient with your hand up. Thank you for waiting. Please unmute yourself or I'll try. Okay. There you go, Emmy.
Okay, thanks. I'm confused. So if you are on probation, right? Mm-hmm. You have to register, and you can't travel overseas when you're on probation, right?
That's not 100% true. You have to get the permission of your probation officer to do that. It's rarely granted, but I know of at least two people that were able to get that approval.
Okay. So then, let's say you're on probation for 10, 15 years, and then you're off probation. Yes. So you still have to register when you're off probation?
Yes. Well, it depends on the state. But in California, just because you get off of parole or probation does not mean your requirement to register ends, right? You're still required to register, but you don't have those additional restrictions of parole or probation.
But you're still on the registry.
Correct.
Okay. But you don't have restrictions about where you can live, and then you can travel, right?
Amy, are you talking about people who live in California or another state?
Well, I'm in Missouri, so I'm talking about Missouri. But it's a federal. Does it make any difference?
No. No, because, okay, and folks, I know it's confusing. There's federal laws that, you know, you can be convicted of a federal sex offense law, or you can be convicted of a state sex offense laws. And mm-hmm. But the requirement to register is actually a state requirement.
Oh. Yeah. So then let's just say you're off the rate. Or not, you're not up there registry, but you are not probation anymore.
Yes.
You want to travel overseas, do you still have to do the 21 day to ask? And is it still on your passport if you don't even travel until you're off of the probation?
Well, this is a federal law. So the International Megan's Law is a federal law. And if you're, quote, a covered sex offender, then yes, you have to give a 21 day notice. And yes, you have to have the unique identifier on your passport.
Oh. Okay, no matter how many, forever, basically.
Yes, for now, anyway.
All right, let's change that. Thank you.
Yes, and please know, we did challenge the International Megan's Law as soon as it was, in fact, became effective. Unfortunately, we were not successful in our challenge. So it's still the law. But I'm just incensed. And one of the arguments I made in court about that unique identifier is to point out to the judge, the federal district court judge, that the only countries that ever had unique identifiers on the passports of their citizens were Nazi Germany and the USSR. That's it. That's the beginning. That's the end. And I said, we really should not want to be part of that group, right? The judge didn't buy it that day. And we consulted with an expert, and that expert said, if you go to the Ninth Circuit, you're going to lose. But I'm still looking for the perfect plaintiff. So if, in fact, you're convicted of a misdemeanor sex offense, blah, 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 then, in fact, I might be willing to go back to court again. But it's really difficult. And the unique identifier, to me, situation is even so much worse, because these days, when you apply for a passport, if you are, quote, a covered sex offender, you have to request that the unique identifier be added to your passport. I'm like, are you kidding? It's like, yes, please brand me here, brand my passport. But if you don't do that again, and you get a passport that doesn't have the unique identifier on it, it's altogether possible that, in fact, your passport can be revoked at any time. And I talked about the one gentleman, and by the way, he's an outlier, the only person I know that happened to, but I'm so horrified by what happened to him and his wife. I mean, think about it. They had this great celebration plan for 30 years of marriage. They had friends waiting for them in Europe, and they never got to Europe. So that they didn't get to Europe. Okay. We've talked about Europe a lot, and I'm glad that we did, because Europe is not completely open book, but it's a mostly open book. I will warn you that the United Kingdom will not allow you to come visit if, in fact, you are a covered sex offender. Okay. The whole United Kingdom, they say, no, we don't want you here. I'm happy to report that a person, actually two people that I know who are no longer required to register, were able to get into the UK after they, because they were no longer required to register. So it's possible in the future. And for you too, Emmy, I hope that you can in Missouri get off the registry, and then you can go to the United Kingdom. Okay, let's talk about other parts of the world though. Folks, don't try to go to Asia. You will not be allowed to enter Asia. This is because of those Asian countries. They do not want you there. By the way, many airlines will sell you a ticket to go to Asia. You'll get there to the airport, and you will not be allowed to leave the airport. So I know quite a few people who paid a lot of money and spent a lot of time trying to get to Asia, an Asian country only be turned around once they get there. So here's another example. One of my clients, his wife is a Japanese citizen. They went to Japan. They live in California. They went to Japan to buy a second home. And when they were there to buy the second home, guess what happened? They wouldn't let him out of the airport in Tokyo. So they did not buy a second home because he was not allowed outside the airport. So don't waste your time. Don't waste your money trying to travel to Asia. As far as other places, Africa is something that some countries say yes, some countries say no. Central America, the same thing. Some say yes and some say no. We have a hand up right now. So let's go ahead with the hand. Just says iPhone.
Now, does that include Philippines and Thailand?
Yes, sir.
Mm, very interesting.
Yeah. To the point where I know that, even in the International Megan's Law case that I filed, somebody, his wife was a Philippine citizen and he was not allowed to go, not allowed to enter. Rick, you have your hand up, sir.
Yeah, I did. I spent a night in Manila Airport to be turned around in the Philippines. So yes, the Philippines will not allow covered sex offenders to enter their country.
Thank you, Rick, for that information. I have no pleasure in telling you this, sharing this information with you, but I think it's better that you know that ahead of time. Here's another situation where one of my clients was going on a business trip to South Korea. That's what he wanted to do. They sold him a ticket. The airline sold him a ticket and everything. He got to the airport. So slightly different. He got to the airport and they wouldn't let him on the flight, but he was going there on a business trip. He's trying to get there on a business trip and to finalize a contract with this large South Korean company, and he never got there. Fortunately, he had a business partner who did get there and they did get the contract, but it's just things like that. It's the uncertainty of it. It's the embarrassment of it. It's more than embarrassment, folks. It's a stigma. It's a scarlet letter, but this is what's going on. And by the way, one of the things that our country says is, well, we're not stopping them from visiting the Philippines or South Korea or, you know, these other countries. We're not stopping them. It's the country. By the way, Mexico and Canada also will not allow registrants to fly into their countries. There might be another way to get there, but not to fly into the countries. It's, again, we need to share this with you so that, in fact, you don't go to the trouble or the expense of traveling to these countries. So two other things I want to say. I'll go back to Europe for just a minute. There's some things going on in Europe that affect everybody who's traveling to Europe, not just people on the registry. One of them is called the EES, the entry exit system. And that's not something you have to do ahead of time. Once you get to the country, then they're going to take your photo and your fingerprint. Okay. And if you don't want to let them take your photograph, if you don't want to let them have your fingerprints, guess what? They're not going to let you enter the country. Again, this is not limited to people required to register, but to everybody. And that system is already in place. There's another one that is supposed to go into effect in October. I'll mention it briefly and let you know that it's been the effective date for this has been changed many times in many years. But here we go. It's called the European Travel Information and Authorization System, or ETIAS. And in fact, this is something that when it becomes effective, you will have to do it before you travel to those countries. And thank you. Roger's putting information and links in the chat right now, and you can go there. So again, it's supposed to go into effect October of this year. It's been delayed at least 3 years before. So we'll see if it actually goes into effect now. And supposedly you have to get approval before you go to the country. It's not a visa, by the way. They're very clear in saying it's not a visa. They're calling it a permit. But again, it's something you would have to apply for before you go. And these include the 29 Schengen nations, by the way. And supposedly it all happens online. You get approval supposedly in 10 minutes, but it says, or up to 30 days. Why am I even mentioning this? I'm concerned because there's some questions, and again, it's not in effect yet, but there's some questions about whether or not you were convicted of a serious offense. But they don't really describe what a serious offense is. They do list a few things like terrorism, right? But I'm concerned that they're going to say, oh, and by the way, it's supposed to be in the last 10 years, but I don't know if that means you're still that you're required to register still, or in fact, you were convicted more than 10 years ago. The system is completely untested. That's a concern that I have, but again, it's something that in fact is not even in place yet. And again, it's the ETIAS system. Okay. Alrighty, Rim. I'm looking at the time and thinking that some people have been asking me questions about the tiered registry law. So I'm going to skip over a couple of things to get to the tiered registry law. And we're talking about the tiered registry law in California only. Okay. Way back when.
Dennis, before we do,
yes,
before sir. We do, I just wanted to mention, in case some people do leave because it's California topic, we have a matching gift program. Did you want to mention the details on that?
Well, how about if you mention that while I make a quick trip to the restroom?
Sure. We have a generous donor who will match every dollar that you give now. So you're doubling your effort. So if you want to see double the effort done, double the work that we can do, that's exactly your opportunity now to do that. So any donation you make, whether it's on our page, on any of our pages, if you mail a check, there's instructions, it will all be doubled, which I think is incredibly cool. So it doesn't happen that often that we get that. So please take advantage of that. And also consider putting Axol in your will. I mean, wouldn't that be cool to be fighting for justice, even beyond our lives? I put them in my will. So there's many, and those of you who were fortunate enough to own stocks, you can donate appreciated stock and write it off if you donate it to our foundation. So that's a way you get a tax benefit, and you can donate to Axol's education efforts. So lots of different ways, opportunities, but take advantage of that double donation now. I think you'll.
Okay, thank you, Roger, for the important information you shared, as well as giving me an opportunity to use the restroom. Okay, so let's go back to the tiered registry law. It passed here in California in the year 2017. That was after almost 7 years of lobbying on our part. And my understanding is that was a pretty short period of time. It seemed like forever, but we finally got it done. We passed it. It got passed in 2017, and then it did not become effective until 2021. And that was July 1 of 2021. So we're almost at exactly 5 years into the petitioning process. And I will tell you, it is going relatively well. And so I know myself, I have filed about 200 petitions so far. And as of today, 152 of them have been granted, and the rest of them are still pending. So it takes some time, up to 6 months for each petition to get through the process. There in the petitioning process, people usually ask me, just plan on from the time the petition is filed till you get the answer from the judge. It'll be 6 months. Okay. It might happen a little quicker depending on the county where the petition is filed, but the fact is it can take up to 6 months. And the fact is too, that during that process, after the petition is filed, the next step is that law enforcement makes a determination about whether or not you're eligible, whether you're eligible to petition, because not everybody is eligible to petition, unfortunately. About half of the people on the registry today in California are eligible to petition at some point in time. For some people assigned to Tier 1, it's 10 years. For people assigned to Tier 2, it's 20 years, provided that some other things, you're not on parole or probation, currently for something else, there's some provisos there. But for most people, it's 10 years and 20 years that you can, in fact, file your petition. It's not automatic for anybody, folks. And the ultimate decision is, in fact, made by a judge. And I think, actually, that's a good thing. And the legislators, by the way, they're scaredy cats, right? They don't want to have to make that decision person by person whether or not somebody should basically have their requirement to register terminated. So they, in fact, said, okay, it's going to go through a judge. Can you file your own petition? Yes, you can file your own petition. Many people don't want to do it for PTSD and other reasons, but it is possible that you can file your own petition. There's multiple steps just in the filing process, and some people say it's just too difficult, too onerous for me to do it myself. So many times they hire a legal professional to do them. The first step is law enforcement makes a determination whether or not you're eligible. They have up to 60 days to make that determination. By the way, they don't have to tell you what their determination is. So you're basically going to sit in a cone of silence or in a fog bank 4 months, because the next 2 months, the district attorney has to decide whether or not to object to your petition. Okay. If the district attorney objects to your petition, guess what? You need to have a lawyer then, because you're going to go in front of a judge and there's going to be a hearing. Now, and I'm happy to say that very few district attorneys now are, in fact, objecting to petitions. That's because of two appellate decisions. One is called Purple People versus Ty, and the other one's called People versus Franco. And both of those decisions say the district attorney must prove that you pose a current danger to the community in order for the judge to deny your petition. This is fabulous, fabulous news, because otherwise, the way when the petitioning process started, the DAs were saying that, oh, it's up to the petitioner, okay, the registrant, to prove that they don't pose a current danger. And that's an extremely difficult thing to do, right? But these appellate decisions say, no, 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 it is the DA's responsibility to prove that, in fact, you pose a current danger. Now, guess what? The one reason that is so sweet is, in fact, that there's no method that they can require you to go get an assessment done, a current assessment. They might look at your static score, your static 99 score, but for somebody, remember, on tier two, you've been out of prison for at least 20 years, right? So they can't say you're the same person as you were there, especially if you have 20 years in the community and you don't have any other convictions. So it's a worthwhile thing to do. I said I've gotten 152 people off the registry. I will tell you, there's more than 10,000 people in the state of California who are no longer required to register because of the petitioning process. So in some counties, the fact is that the public defender's office will do it for you. Okay. So I said some people, I know John Weston, you're here on the line. You could certainly do that. Jailhouse lawyers, you can do it yourself. But the other people, you don't want to bother with the process, and please don't worry about it. Hire a legal professional to do it, and it can be done. It's interesting that not as many people have applied for a petition as was expected. I was at a sex offender management board meeting not that long ago, where they revealed they thought in the very first year that the petitioning process was going to be in existence, they were expecting 30,000 people to apply. We're not even half at that mark yet, okay, statewide. I do not know why. I think some people are afraid. You know, you've gotten battered and bruised going through the legal system before. Perhaps that's why. But the fact is, if in fact you are eligible or even think you're eligible, contact me. We have, remember, 5 attorneys on our board. We can help you figure out whether or not you're eligible, at least give you an educated guess. You still have to go through the formal process with the law enforcement. But the fact is that if in fact you're eligible, it's really important that you take advantage of that situation. And think about it. Assembly Bill 1568 that we just defeated, that was going to make the petitioning process very difficult, if not impossible, for thousands of people. So we just don't know when the law is going to change, right? And so please, if you're eligible, as soon as you're eligible, please, please, please go ahead and start your petitioning process. I did mention, you know, tier one, 10 years, tier two is 20 years. And by the way, tier three, if you're unfortunate enough to be assigned to tier three at this point, you're not eligible to petition. And if you were to file a petition with the court, it would in fact be dismissed, not denied, but just dismissed, which means without prejudice. Kelly, I see that your hand is up and you've been so patient waiting. So please, this is a good time to ask your question about the tiered registry.
Yes. I believe I am tier one, but I've been out of state, so I never received a letter. How do I obtain that confirmation?
When you move back into the state of California, they will assign you to a tier. They being the Department of Justice, okay? So it depends on your conviction offense. Kelly, were you actually convicted in California originally?
Yes, LA County.
Okay, that's actually a good thing, and I'll tell you why. Because the tier assignments are based upon conviction offense. And for people who are convicted outside of California, it takes up to 2 years. The law allows them up to 2 years to determine what this equivalent offense is. But if you were convicted in California, they know what that is. So Kelly, contact me separately. I don't want to tell you on the phone here, on the Zoom meeting, in fact, what your tier assignment is. But I'd be happy to help you if you just contact me next week.
Will do. I'll hold my other questions for then too.
Do you think they're of general interest?
It really just how the time in Texas may affect this. And also, I'll be moving to Riverside County. So is there any concern county to county, living one place?
Okay. Well, let's address the first part of this first, which has to be with registering out of state. So when I say that a person assigned to tier one has to register for 10 years, you don't necessarily have to register in the state of California. I'm really happy to report that. We had the previous law that allowed very few people off the registry did require 5 years in the state of California before they could apply. apply. This is not true for tiered registry law. So once you move back to California, in fact, they will assign you to a tier relatively quickly, but that's because you're convicted in the state of California. And the time that you spend out of state counts towards that, as long as you registered outside the state. I will tell you, if you live outside the country, though, that could be a problem. And so that one case, of all the cases I have filed, the only one that was not successful was somebody, he was on tier two, and the fact is that he had spent half of his time in Mexico, and Mexico doesn't have a sex offender registry, so he was unable to register for those 10 years. And anyway, the court ruled that, in fact, those 10 years in Mexico did not count, and so I think it'd be true no matter what other country somebody goes to. So in other words, if you have time that you register in another state, that will count for it, but not in another country.
So maybe you can elaborate a bit more on who needs to hire an attorney versus filing themselves. Assuming I'm tier one, low Serrato score, no issues.
What I would say, Kelly, is anybody who's hearing this either today or on the recording can contact me. I can send you the instructions for it, and then you can look at that and decide whether or not you feel capable of doing it. The form itself is not that difficult. The difficult part, I swear, is what you have to do. You have to file a copy of the petition with the court, then you get a confirmed copy back, then you have to serve copies of the petition on different parties. And some people just throw their hands up and go, that's just too difficult. And by the way, I think, Kelly, are you going, okay, you mentioned Riverside County. Were you convicted in Riverside County?
No, Los Angeles County.
Okay. So important for everybody to know is you file your petition in the county where you currently reside and not the county where you're convicted, if that, in fact, is a different county. You'll have to serve the county where you were convicted, but you don't file there. You file in the county where you currently reside. I know you asked about Riverside County. I don't think I've had any particular problems with Riverside County as far as the petitioning process. I will tell you the two counties that are the fastest, though, in processing the petitions are Ventura County down south and Alameda County up north. So those are the two fastest counties. If you have some flexibility about where to move, you wanted the process to be a couple of months shorter, but it's just a couple of months. Alameda County and Ventura counties are good at that.
How much time would you add to your 6-month estimate having to serve LA County from after filing in Riverside?
None. 6 months is conservative. Most of the time petitions are granted, or most times you get a decision on your petition in less than 6 months, but I say 6 months is kind of the rule of thumb. And then guess what? If it happens in 5 months, I've over-delivered.
Last question. And so moving out of Texas, when I check out, does that remove me from the Texas registry?
I have no idea. You'll have to talk to a Texas attorney about that. I don't know.
Okay.
I will say, though, if a person on the registry moves out of California, California automatically takes you off the registry, but I don't know about Texas. But I could refer you to a Texas attorney if you want to ask that question.
SP 384, I'm going to focus on that first. Then I'll look into that one. Thank you for your information.
You're very welcome. Okay, Marina, you've been very patient. You've had your hand up for a while.
Hi, my husband moved to Imperial County out of Arizona 18 months ago, still waiting tier assignment. Understand it's going to take up to 24 months, but we were hoping it would take 24 months, but still waiting. Our concern is the first time he went to ask for his 8050 form, it took a month and phone calls and different people to even know what an 8050 was. And in fact, when he went in to update his address, an apartment number, but asked for an 8050. Again, the people that were working did not know what an 8050 was, so they just printed off his registration that has his picture and says that he's registered. Who updates the information if he gets an 8050? Does the DOJ update that information, or do they send an email to Imperial County and tell them to update the information? I don't trust Imperial County to do anything.
Okay, so Marina, you've asked an important question here. And by the way, she mentioned something on 8050. That's a form 8050, and the name of the form is proof of current registration. Okay, so proof of current registration is indeed a different form than your annual registration form. It is a two-page form, and your tier assignment is listed on page one of the two-page form. Okay, so the fact is, And Marina, I assume you were ultimately successful getting an 80-50. And the question then I think is, well, what happens after you get if you were to get a new tier assignment? It's not automatic and they will not notify you of that. So I send a letter to the Department of Justice requesting a new tier assignment. And so let's just say, I mean, when would that ever happen? It could happen, in fact, if a person had a wobbler offense, which is initially a felony, but if you request a reduction from the court, they can in fact reduce it to a misdemeanor. And so if some offenses, including, by the way, possession of child pornography, you would move actually from tier 3 all the way down to tier 1 if in fact that was reduced to a misdemeanor. So in that situation, I would write a letter to the Department of Justice and request a new tier assignment. And yes, indeed, you have to go back to the law enforcement office and request a new 8050. But folks, before the petition is filed, and I know somebody asked a question about, I guess it was you, Kelly, asked a question about, well, can you do it yourself? Yes, you can. But one of the things you need to know, too, is that you need to file when you file your petition, the 8050 form needs to accompany the petition and it needs to be filed in court.
Okay. He doesn't even have a tier assignment yet. But when he does go in and they give him the 8050 and it has a tier and it still says TBD on it, I guess what I'm asking is the DOJ, do they input that tier into the computer so as soon as Imperial County pulls it up, it appears? Or does Imperial County just get a message and say, hey, by the way, update his information?
Oh, it is. The DOJ does enter it into the computer database. So at least that part's efficient.
Oh, well, that's good. All right. That I feel a little bit more comfortable. And also, since the offense actually, I think, might be a tier 3, but it was an attempted offense in Arizona, does that make that a lower tier? Is what we're praying for.
Well, we filed a lawsuit against the Department of Justice because they were, in fact, assigning people who were convicted of an attempted offense to the same tier as if the offense had been completed. Okay. So the general rule, so we filed a lawsuit. We said, that's wrong. That, you know, that doesn't make sense. And we were successful. So for many people in California, if indeed you were convicted of an attempted offense, then in fact, it is a lower tier.
Okay. This is one of those things that I think the California Sex Offender Management Board has recommended to be a lower tier. And but it hasn't, I guess it hasn't passed. It was the age thing. So anyway, you've answered my questions. I appreciate you.
And I appreciate you, Marina. Thanks for asking. And I know somebody else had her hand up. I had her hand up and now she's gone. So Joyce, if you can hear me, because that was who it was. If you can hear me, please put your hand up again. We'd be happy to listen to what you have to say. Okay, so we're talking about the tiered registry now. There is some litigation that's ongoing that people should know about. And the case has a strange name, but here we go. It's People versus Trout-Castro. People versus Trout-Castro. And so the reason I'm bringing it up is a judge denied a petition even though the person had been, their tier had been reassigned. And so the person was tier was, I think, from tier 3 down to tier 1. The judge said, I don't care. I'm not granting this petition. In fact, I'm denying the petition. So that was Mr. Trout-Castro, by the way. And so he did his own, he filed his own petition, by the way. And it was denied. And so then he hired an attorney, not me, a different attorney who's also good at what he does. And so in that specific case, it's on appeal. And the interesting thing is it had to do with somebody and convicted of 288.2, Penal Code Section 288.2, which is basically a sting operation, a sting offense. And so and there was a case before that called People versus Manzor. And People versus Manzor, that case said that offense can, even people convicted of misdemeanor 288.2 have to register. So that it didn't make any difference. Tier designation couldn't be changed by Department of Justice or anybody else. So in Trout-Castro, that case, the Manzor case has been brought up as precedent, but this is a the great news. In Prepil versus Trout Castro, the Department of Justice has weighed in, and they have basically said, look, judges, this is our decision to make about what's a proper tier assignment and not your decision. That's a really bold move by the Department of Justice. I'm really very happy that they made that decision. They filed that legal brief, because that doesn't happen very often, but it did in fact happen. So stay tuned. We're waiting for the decision in Prepil versus Trout Castro. I believe because the Department of Justice weighed in on this, I think that in fact this man's petition is going to be granted, and that there will be good precedent for us here too, that in fact basically whatever the tier assignment Department of Justice gives you is what rules, and not what the DA thinks, and not even what the judge thinks. Again, that's just for the tier assignment. I'm not talking about the ultimate decision about whether or not a petition will be granted. Okay. All right. Are there any questions or comments now about the tiered registry law? Because if not, I think I'll go back to a couple of things I skipped over because I was afraid we weren't going to have enough time for this. Okay. So we really are busy litigating. Another lawsuit that's pending right now is in fact has to do with Fresno County. Fresno County passed an ordinance that basically limited the number of registrants who could live in a home. That's to me a residency restriction. Looks like a residency restriction, smells like one, et cetera. So we sued them, and we are optimistic that we will prevail because of something called preemption. So we believe that there are state laws regarding residency restrictions for people on, you know, required to register, and that because a state has spoken on the subject, that a county cannot basically do something different. So we've won other arguments, other cases based on that argument, and we're using that argument now. We've got a hearing, a case management conference coming up on July 1. That's really more about scheduling and things like that. But we do our plan to file a motion for summary judgment in the case, and we have in fact scheduled a hearing on October 29th in the case. And again, this is Fresno County here in California passing a residency restriction, which we believe is preempted by state law, and so we're moving forward. So that is pending. And I know the treatment issues. Let's talk about registrants who are on parole. We have filed multiple lawsuits about registrants, how registrants on parole are being treated as far as treatment is concerned. So the first lawsuit had to do with the fact that the Department of Corrections was breaking the law. Always interesting when your Department of Corrections is acting unlawfully, but in fact they were. And so what I meant by that is in fact that what they were doing, they had a policy, the Department of Corrections, which wasn't even written down anywhere, but this was just their policy. And so they basically were requiring all registrants on parole to undergo treatment the entire time they're on parole. Now, folks, we have people on parole in California for up to 20 years. That's a really long time. Are you going to make somebody undergo treatment the whole time? I don't think so. And by the way, that's not what the law says. It can be that long, but it's not required to be that long. So anyway, what happened is the Department of Corrections said, oh, you caught us. We are breaking the law. So I tell you what, we'll issue new regulations. Well, they issued these new regulations, and now they're not following their new regulations. So we filed a new lawsuit that's pending that basically says that had to do with many things, but specifically about containment meetings. I guess this is the one that is the most upsetting to me, that people, number one, are not being allowed to participate in their own containment meetings. And number two, that Department of Corrections is not giving them a form that explains why they need to continue in treatment. So it's a CDCR form 3043, if you want to know. Again, CDCR form 3043. And that is supposed to be explain why further treatment is required. And by the way, we're talking about treatment beyond 1 year, because the law says treatment for at least a year. It doesn't say the maximum amount of time, but it says at least 1 year. And then after that, the determination is supposed to be made on a case-by-case basis. Does this person in fact need more treatment or not? And if so, then guess what, CDCR, you have to put it in writing. And so many people are not getting, and by the way, that written document has to be given to the parolee within 30 days of the containment meeting. So Joyce, I'm going to call on you first. Paul, please wait. Joyce was with us earlier in line. Joyce, please.
Hi, I'm sorry I couldn't enter before, but something went wrong with my phone. But I want to know, is there anything being done now to move people who have seen illegal pictures from 3 to 1? And can I do anything personally to help move this along?
Thank you, Joyce, for that question. And I guess maybe I'm not finished with the tiered registry because I didn't talk about that. And I'm glad that you brought it up. So folks, we're not happy with the tiered registry law. It's better than it used to be because before it was really every person on the registry was on the registry for life. And that was not acceptable. So as I said, we worked really hard. We got the tiered registry law passed. But guess what? Not enough people now are eligible to petition for removal. So that's why we are very involved, and we have been lobbying the state legislature to try to get people like the category of people, Joyce, that you mentioned, people convicted of possessing child pornography, get them off at tier three. And by the way, our recommendation has been taken from tier three all the way down to tier one. And folks, think about it. This is a nonviolent, no contact offense. Why in the heck would they be on tier three? It makes absolutely no sense. So the good thing is, too, we have persuaded the Sex Offender Management Board to adopt that position, and they have, and the Sex Offender Management Board has made a formal recommendation to the legislature to do just that. Take people who are convicted of possessing child pornography from tier three all the way down to tier one. But remember, tier three means not eligible to petition. Tier one means after 10 years. So we are making an extra effort, Joyce, right now, preparing for next year and the next legislative session to, in fact, introduce a bill that would, in fact, do just that. And by the way, move some other people off of tier three and down to either tier two or to tier one. I will mention one specifically because I know many people who are affected by this, Penal Code Section 288, parentheses C, right now are on Tier 3, and we have convinced the Sex Offender Management Board to move that down to Tier 2. I do believe these changes are going to be made. I just can't tell you what year they're going to be made, but trust me that Axol is working very hard to make that happen, Joyce.
Can we do anything personally besides send you some little money or something?
Well, and Joyce has been very generous in her donations, and we really appreciate that, Joyce. You know what? Next year there will be. There'll be phone calls to make. There'll be letters to write. And we'll be sure and let you know when that happens.
Okay. Thank you, Janice.
And thank you, Joyce. Take care. Bye. Paul, you've had your hand up for a bit. Thank you for being patient.
Janice, currently I went through one of those meetings between the treatment and what do you call it? A containment meeting.
Yes.
And I never received the form. There was one containment meeting that they didn't even call me on. I had no idea that it took place. Mm-hmm. And so when I asked my parole agent for that form and I showed him the Title 15 that said that he had to give it to me, he said he would. He still hasn't yet. However, at the containment meeting, the treatment center said that I was done, that I was far above anybody else. There was no reason for me to stay in treatment. The meeting required another polygraph. And I read the National Academy of Science, and their review of polygraphs is about 60% accurate. And also it can be messed up by PTSD. So I failed my last polygraph on what I was thinking. Not anything I did, not having any, bad material or anything, but just what I was thinking. And my parole officer said something like, well, they need the money. And that's what they've been doing. I talked to several others in the group. And as soon as they get ready to come out of treatment, they have to have another polygraph and they fail it. And so my question is from what I understand, getting off early of parole and the treatment center is supposed to be totally different. And it's up to the treatment center to decide whether or not we need to be in treatment. But yet the parole board or my parole officer at that containment meeting is combining the two.
Paul, if that is indeed happening and we can find hard evidence of it, I'd be happy to file a lawsuit on your behalf. That's unconscionable.
I'm waiting for the form now. I asked him again yesterday or the day before yesterday, and he says, oh, yeah, I'll get it for you. But they're not giving any of it out. He was surprised that I brought him the actual Title 15 that said that we're entitled to it within 30 days. And so the treatment center says I'm done, and yet I'm still in treatment. And they're actually angry because it's the parole office now that is keeping me in treatment.
I wish I was surprised by what you're telling me. I'm not. And I'll tell you why, because I think in the treatment, and folks, just so you know, we have over 7,000 people who are both on the registry and on parole. This is not a small number. This is over 7,000 people who are, again, registrants on parole. So what's happening a lot is parole or DAPO, right? They point the finger at the treatment providers, and then the treatment providers sometimes point the finger at DAPO. And they're both saying, oh, it's not my fault. Thank you, John, there. It's not my fault. It's their fault, right? And so games are being played, and that's why we're going to keep filing lawsuits.
The thing is, I'm 66 years old. My crime happened when I was 18. I had a failure to register, which gave me a 25-year-to-life sentence, one charge of failing to register. And so I came out of that, and now I'm in treatment again. It has been 45 years. And so it's hurting more than helping, because I'm bringing up things that are long since resolved 45 years ago. And yet here I am in the same boat, 66 years old.
I'm just stunned, Paul, by what you're telling me. I wish it weren't true, but please call me next week so we can have a personal conversation that's not being recorded. And I'll just say, in general, folks, the parole system is really broken. And the fact is that neither parole nor the treatment providers have an incentive to stop anybody's treatment. They just don't, right? The treatment providers are getting paid very well by parole, by the way, for treating people, supposedly treating people. And parole, guess what? Their budget's bigger if they have more people under their supervision. So the number 7,000 plus has not changed in years. And it's wrong. And by the way, I'm also hearing some rumors. I don't have any facts to back it up yet, that people now are getting out of being released from jail and prison, and there's no room for them in the current treatment programs. So they're basically going untreated. I don't know for how long period of time, but I've heard months at least, and that's wrong as well. So there's a lot of problems with the treatment providers and DAPO, and we'll get to the bottom of it eventually. We'll see how many lawsuits we have to file. Okay, Mr. iPhone or Ms. iPhone, your hand is up.
Hi, Janice. So yeah, so I've been on reduced services 4 months now, and so in our group, we don't have an agenda. So our clinician, she basically says, you know, you guys are on your way out, but on our last meeting, she had made a comment, you know, that she has to cycle us out in order to get other people in. But basically, their agenda is to keep us in reduced services for a year. So it's like, we don't have an agenda, but you have to keep us in there for a year, you know, according to their, you know, program or whatever. And it's like, you know, the whole point for reduced services is to get us out. We've already been in regular services the month, you know, every week and everything else for, you know, to get into reduced services. And now we don't even have an agenda where we're doing anything. We're just showing up once a month and just checking in kind of thing, talking basically. And you're going to keep us in there for a year because you have a timeline of each person that you have to cycle out. So you can't just kick people out. You have to, each person that came in before the other has to go out at their containment. And then when the next person comes up to containment, you can get them out, you know. So if somebody else came in before me and my containment comes up before theirs, you can't get me out because they were in there before me. And it's like, how is that right?
It's not right, but I will tell you, it'll be difficult to prove. And so, you know, we're filing the lawsuits that we can based upon resources, but based upon two finding plaintiffs who are willing to be a plaintiff and people who are willing to challenge the system. The system's broken, folks. I mean, the whole registry system is broken. But I will tell you, the treatment system is even more broken than the overall registry. So as I said, there's games being played within treatment, and we just have to keep suing them until, in fact, they do the right thing. So thank you. Emmy, you have your hand up?
Okay. One more question. What you said before about the residency restrictions,
yes,
how they were trying to say how many people can live in a is that only in California that you were talking about?
Yeah, it's not even a statewide law, it's a county ordinance. Yes.
How can I find out if anything like that exists in Missouri?
Talk to a Missouri attorney. Look up if you would, Matt Fry, M-A-T-T, first name Fry, F-R-Y. Matt actually worked with me on my lawsuit in Missouri. And so he was my local counsel.
Okay. Because they won't let people live together here. And it makes it so hard. I just thought if there's a law like that here, it might be something that we can look into.
Okay. Well, give Mr. Fry a call. And if anybody can help you, I think that's him.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. So, folks, I'm looking at my list of topics that I plan to cover today. And I have to say, I've covered them all. I want to thank you all for being here today. It's really important that we share this information. I hope that you'll look into emotional support group meetings. Our next Zoom meeting is on July 18th, and I hope to see you on July 18th. Take care, everyone. Have a great weekend. Bye-bye.